My name is Tom Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we will be discussing The Book of Eli. If you have not seen it, fast forward to the 3x3 because we are going to be discussing it in detail and that will include spoilers. I am here today with Christian Malarkey.
In place of a joke here, I just want to say best dramatic feature, Avatar.
That's the Golden Globes. Take that as you will. I think it speaks volumes. I am also here with our tagline for the week, Kelly Wand.
No one loves an albatross. And by the way, I thought it was pronounced Christian Malarkey.
Oh, have I been mispronouncing your name,
Davis? Yeah.
Oh, geez, I feel bad about that. That's really embarrassing because I've known you.
I've been whiting it up.
And I've known.
That's okay.
I've known Christian for probably about 5 or 6 months now, I think. I can't believe I mispronounced your name. I apologize.
I pardon you.
I know what that's from. Very good. So let's talk about the Book of Eli. Before we do, by the way, as a disclaimer, we should point out that Book of Eli was written by a fellow who we all internet know, and I'm making air quotes with that, a fellow named Gary Whitta, who is a member of the forum. And we are all hugely proud that he got this made. This is just awesome of him. I mean, he's been plugging away at screenplays for a while. This one finally went through, and we all heartily congratulate him. Now, that said, even though Mr. Whitta is sort of a friend of ours, we discussed and we decided we are all going to be brutally honest about what we thought of the movie, and that might include some criticism of some of the stuff that Gary might have done or might not have done or whatever. But there was going to be a little bit of brutal honesty here. Now, we also have not discussed what we thought of the movie yet. So,
even though that, what you just said, is a huge spoiler for you.
Well,
by the way, there will be spoilers. So if you have not seen the movie, turn this off.
And it's pretty spoilery. And I actually had the spoiler ruined for me in the middle of the movie.
Oh, that he
so
was.
I left infuriated. So that colored my own impressions.
How did it get ruined in the middle of the movie? Were you like
the
reading?
Dumb guy goes, "Oh, you know what I heard? That's obviously not true." And then he said what it was.
Wait, who said this?
The dumb guy who made me walk out of Where the Wild Things Are. So now he's ruined the podcast twice.
Wait, your buddy is sitting there talking to you, saying these things during movies?
He said this one thing. That's the only thing he said in the movie, and of course, and then he said what it was.
You need to stop being friends with this guy.
Yeah, I know.
Take your mom to these movies, not that guy.
Good Lord.
I only take her to the gay movies. Like,
well.
Yeah, well, spoiler alert.
Well, let's, so by the way, the twist is that he's gay. Oh, what I'm saying, gay. Then he's blind.
He's the Christian Daredevil, Marvel Comics Daredevil.
Well played, Tom, well played.
Yeah.
So who wants to go first? You know what? I'm going to go ahead and go first. Are you guys ready? I loved, loved, loved the idea of this movie. The basic concept, I think I'm immensely fond of. So as the kernel for a script, I think it's an amazing bit of work and I adored it. However, the execution, I was so consistently and throughout disappointed by the movie. But I do want to talk at some point about why I loved the concept.
Because you're a Christianity apologist. That's why you love it.
I mean, I don't know if you're being serious or not, but that's definitely part of it. I mean, I have a degree in biblical studies, and I just loved the way that I loved what could have been done with this and what I think should have been done with it and some of the basic concept. But overall, I didn't care for it and was hugely disappointed by it.
I'm very excited that you said that because I'm excited to talk about that same thing because I actually really admire exactly what you're talking about. I'm especially impressed with just that somebody comes up with an idea that has this much potential. Not just that it's a million-dollar idea, which it is, and I kudos for coming up with an idea like this because we all sort of sit around thinking about this. But I loved what could have developed around it, and I agree that I was constantly disappointed by the execution.
Kelly,
I was not constantly disappointed. I liked the first half, and then my weed wore off, and then I hated the second half.
Well,
and I left. So it's basically like every other movie I see.
No, you did not leave.
No. Okay. I meant I left after the movie, but I really liked the opening, and I liked that scene with Tom Waits and Denzel Washington at the beginning.
That was my favorite scene in the movie.
That's easily the best scene in the movie. Yeah.
It was like that scene in Once Upon a Time in the West where they set up the Eli Wallach character. Never mind.
In fact, when they send Sayonara into his room, I was just wishing. I was wishing, could they just send Tom Waits in there and have the scene?
Tom Waits disappears, and Malcolm McDowell shows up at the end. And, I don't know. Go on.
It just led me to think, is there any movie that isn't improved just a little bit by sending Tom Waits in?
Yeah.
I love that guy.
Yeah. And just the whole, that you know, the bartering and whipping out the little KFC wet nappy wipe things. And
The sounds they're making. Oh, yeah. There's like an Altman scene.
Well, the KFC wet and nappy things, I hate product placement. And there are two things. This movie had a couple of product placements that just made me just grit my teeth.
What was the other one?
Placement and there's a truck that shows Bush.
Oh, right.
There's a bunch of stores that you see. There's a shit ton of product placement that and I know it's a reality that you have to deal with. I understand that, but when he kept showing, just holding up the KFC thing, I know it turned me off.
I didn't even think of either of those as product placement. I mean, you know what, you're right, those things are never random in there. The Bush truck one, I remember noticing it, but not even thinking. And the same with the KFC things, not even thinking, oh yeah, that's product placement. So in those instances, it worked for me.
Well, I loved the little touches in that scene. I guess we're just jumping right to that scene, but there's so much beautiful back and forth between the two of them in that bartering scene. And the thing I loved best was when Tom Waits asked him if he had any toys, and
he goes,
Eli's,
no, I don't play.
Yeah, exactly. That's his answer. No, I don't play.
Under his breath. It's a throwaway line. It's perfect.
It's exactly right. It's a beautiful throwaway. No, I don't play. And you just got the sense of these two actors just working together and their characters just sort of flying. And there's so few other times when that happens in the film.
Because otherwise I really felt like the actors were just sort of comic book broad strokes. I mean, there were none of those kind of moments. I mean, it really could have used some of that. And the weird thing is, one of my big problems with the movie was the pacing and the way it was cut together at certain times. They could have made time for more interaction like that. And I don't know if it was a problem with the way it was written or with the Hughes brothers sort of wanting to push more action pieces or more sort of stylized shots. I don't know what was going on there, but I was so hopeful at that moment, and then there was no follow-up for moments like that. Let's talk about the twist. So that
there's two twists, and one of them's totally given away
by your friend.
No. I think one of the twists is what the book is.
No, wait.
I don't think that's a twist. Well, go ahead, Dingus.
Before we jump to the twist, which I feel like is jumping to the end, just assure me that we're going to go more through this movie as we talk.
Yeah. I think
there's a lot to talk about here, and I don't want to blow our wad just talking about the end and then move on.
Well, the end bugged me because I thought it was an absolute cheat. And
yeah, it is. There's no way around that. It is a total cheat.
And the movie didn't need it. And I hated the fact that it thought it was being clever or why it even did that. I have a couple of theories, but that just didn't work for me at all. And I just was so disappointed that was the twist. I had heard there was a twist going in. And I thought, that's what you're getting. I mean, and it, because there's not enough information. Like, I mean, the moment.
That's why my friend gave it away, because he goes, well, this can't be true halfway in.
Because the moment that Jennifer Beals walks in and she's doing that thing that blind people do, and you know, okay, this character is blind, Denzel Washington never does any of that. And
he does a little bit occasionally. But that rule's broken a lot, too.
Yeah.
Well, he's not doing that on purpose. I think that's learned behavior. But then what you're forced to do at the end of the movie is what you had to do at the end of Sixth Sense, is that you're forced to think back scene by scene through the movie and think, when did they violate it? When did they violate it? When did they violate it? When they could have instead said, let's make an honest movie about a blind man going through an apocalyptic world and just make that movie.
Right.
And how interesting would that have been?
Right.
Instead, I have to sit there and think, oh, he can smell mice. Okay.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He smells.
And why does that change anything? Why does his being blind affect anything at the end?
Because it's a stunner. Because it's bred out of that sixth sense sensibility, which again,
he has a photogenic memory. Is wait, photogenic.
Oops.
See.
But see, I admire that. I admire coming up with that kind of jackpot winning idea. I just have a hard time respecting it as I get to the end of it and think, oh, okay, I've just been cheated. Because yeah. I don't think it bears out when you think through the film.
No, that's why it took him 30 years, because he was wandering around in circles.
It was a pointless gotcha, though, and it doesn't add anything to the characters. It doesn't add anything to the story. The thrill of a movie like the Zatoichi series or Blind Fury is knowing that they're blind and admiring what they're doing because they're blind. You know, right. You don't save that character trait as a gotcha at the end of the movie. It's a fundamental misreading of what makes that kind of story cool. You know, that blind ninja or blind gunfighter or whatever. That it's not a trick. You don't want to trick your audience with that just so that you can have. And it also seems like they did it because in a double cross movie where the one guy gets the bag of gold from the hero, and as he's getting away, he realizes that the bag of gold just has bricks in it.
Right. The switcheroo.
Exactly. I think they were in love with this idea of the switcheroo, and so we have it be Braille, which you didn't need that. You know, if he's got it memorized, it can be blank. You know, it doesn't matter. That whole gotcha is just so pointless.
So it's the last Bible, and it's in Braille?
Yeah, I mean,
like,
you know,
all the other ones are gone, even though it's the most printed book.
So here's the thing that I didn't mind that necessarily. I mean, you've got to, on one hand, do you make a gritty The Road style post-apocalyptic movie? And that's not what I think they were trying here. And on the other hand, do you make a comic book action-y kind of movie? And I think that's more what this leaned towards. And I think when you do that, it's okay to push concepts like every other Bible has been burned and is gone and this is the last one. You know, I'm willing to buy that. I'm willing to have the MacGuffin have some sort of contrivance built up around it. That's okay with me. Because I didn't feel like they were doing this sort of gritty, realistic take.
What about having a Bible that also makes you bulletproof, although not knife-proof? Although we had it in the TV right then.
And that's,
I think the basic problem, though, is letting your MacGuffin become the point of the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a really a dangerous way to go.
Well, because
then I have to evaluate why is this so important, and then I start thinking about what are all the other interesting books or even meaningless books that it would have been far more interesting if that had been the choice at the end instead of the King James version of the Bible or one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, or whatever.
Spoiler alert. Gave away the end of the Dr. Seuss. But did you notice that the Quran was also there, but it was smaller?
Well, there was a bunch. Yeah, there's a bunch of
which another guy brought in the week before.
The blind Muslim.
He's deaf. Yeah.
The deaf Muslim, right? Well, let's talk.
Okay.
Well, let's talk a bit about then what did work with that concept. And what did work with that concept does require for me that is the Bible. So here's my little shtick. Post-apocalyptic movies are unabashedly Westerns. And this movie embraced that. Because what you get from there is, you know, in the ruins of civilization, you're trying to rebuild. And that evokes the frontier setting of a good Western. And, you know, as far back as Road Warrior, this whole Sergio Leone man with no name thing comes in and he cleans up the town and you can have great villains. And instead of guys on horseback, you have guys in cool battered cars. And so post-apocalyptic movies are Westerns. That's easy enough. And clearly Book of Eli appreciated that. What I think gets lost from what was unique in this approach to me was the MacGuffin being a Bible. And the older characters understanding the world that they came from and how values really mattered in that world and wanting to sort of protect those values and use those in different ways. I really liked, you know, in Westerns, you have things like maybe the bad guy wants to build a railroad or something, or you know, they're chasing gold, stuff like that. What the two, the antagonist and the protagonist here wanted were the values of civilization and how to restore that to the world. And that's something unique to a post-apocalyptic setting that you can't just get in a Western, I think. So I really loved the idea that these guys were over 30, they remembered what it was like, and they understood the significance of the Bible, and they thought, like, here are the values we need to bring back to the world. Gary Oldman wanting to use it as a weapon at one point, like he even says, and Denzel Washington just having this, basically, he'd had an epiphany. I mean, there was, you know, there's no getting around the idea that he really felt like he'd been spoken to by God. And I like that. And for a while, I thought the twist was going to be that he was actually an angel, and that was going to explain things like why bullets didn't hurt him and why he was so good at picking a guy off a rooftop halfway down the block with a handgun. You know,
he did that in Fallen already. Did you ever see that movie, Denzel Washington? Mm-hmm.
I did not. Yeah. So that's an innate Denzel Washington ability?
Yeah, angelicism.
Oh, he was an angel in Fallen?
I don't want to spoil
it. Spoiler alert.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's what I thought they were going for. And I'm kind of glad, in a way, they did. Well, I would have rather they did that than the silly, oh, he's blind.
They make him look angelic in that last shot. He's wearing the white robe, and he's transcribing the entire Bible while dying of a bullet wound. And that's the thing, too, is like, there's a lot of the Bible that's not, okay, I know you're the theology major, but I question all these movies that are just suggesting that it's, that the Bible and values are always the same thing.
This movie, there are moments in this movie that suggest that people think that the Bible is the cause of all of these problems.
Right.
But we know
they're wrong. They just didn't understand. I'm tired of these movies where God kills everyone and or turns them into vampires, and then Christianity's the answer to that.
Well, but I don't think – I mean, one of my sort of problems with this, one of the things I'm disappointed in is I think it did have a pretty facile understanding of the Bible, and that might be part of what you're talking about, Kelly. So I agree with you there, but I don't think – like I didn't see any – I don't see it as inherently Christian. I mean, this easily – I just don't think there was a lot there that was specific to Christian values. Values was a shorthand term, I think.
Well, I think the book itself is a comfort to him. I think the writing is a comfort to him, and the words are a comfort to him, and that's what gets him through. I think more than Christianity or an understanding of religion – when I'm talking about Eli here, it's the words of that book that are so meaningful to him, and he says them to her, and they move her in a way that other words haven't moved her, and I think that that's important.
Part of why I think that it's a bit facile, Dingus, is there's a point at the end where they're driving away, and he says something about you know, here's what I've gotten from the book. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto to you. Do you remember that point when they're in the car and I think he's been shot and he's lost it? He's lost the book.
Sure.
And I remember thinking that you read that whole thing and you've got it memorized and that's what you get out of it. I mean, that this little pat thing that you would sew onto needlepoint and frame in your house. I mean, and that's, by the way, is just, even that's a fairly facile understanding of just the Gospels. I mean, there's the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. Yeah. There's the letters
Leviticus.
Of Paul. Yeah, there's so
down
much.
The gaze.
There's so much more to the Bible that the fact that I think it just has a completely facile understanding of what the Bible means. And for instance, when she says to him, "Well, will you read to me from it? Will you tell me a piece of it?" And he says the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah.
I mean,
she's never heard it before.
One of the minor psalms. I mean, that's again, that's such this facile. Okay, we're going to take this little bit from the Bible. Like, I loved right before the scene in the bar where he kills all those guys. I don't know what that passage was, but it was marvelous. It was some lovely poetic, probably something from Isaiah. I don't know, passage that. Okay, I was like, great. This guy knows the Bible, and he's going to bring out these really cool poetic parts of it occasionally. But no, all we get after that is the Lord's Prayer and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I was just so disappointed that the Bible wasn't used more
Well, it's also the point of the story too, is these words matter most. These are the most, this is like the most sought after book, but the Lord's Prayer is the only example you get of why that would be.
Right.
Also, First and Second Chronicles, those kind of repeat other parts of the Bible. Like there's a little bit of overlap in the Bible. So did he have to transcribe all the other stuff and all the begats?
Yeah, sure. he didn't say ditto when he got to those parts.
And there are also parts of like as someone who knows bits of the Bible, I mean, there's it. You could have done some really cool things, and I hate to second guess what the story was doing. But as I was watching, I was thinking maybe they're going to do some of this. There's this sense that he is a prophet himself, you know, that God has told him, take the Bible, carry it as far west as you can get to protect it. And I just didn't feel like prophets in the Bible deal with doubt and reluctance to and being saddled with this, being burdened with this duty and not fully understanding it. And I didn't get any sense here. I mean, he just was told to do something and he had utter conviction that he was going to be safe and he was going to be able to do it. And he did it, which is another reason that I thought, oh, he's going to be an angel, because it didn't seem like the traditional concept of a prophet to me.
But well, he seemed like he was struggling to survive in those early scenes. So that made it seem like he was definitely human to me.
Like to shoot cats and eat them, that kind of thing?
Yeah. And,
yeah.
But Tom, you're talking about a problem that is pervasive in this movie.
Too.
You're talking about a problem that's pervasive in this movie in that there is no sense of stakes or danger whatsoever in it. There's this overall sense of being casual and walking around. There's no sense of just to draw something from that I've seen recently of like an I Am Legend. You know, don't go in the dark. Don't be in the dark. Period. There's no sense of that in this film. There's no sense of Mila Kunis ever really being in danger. You never believe she's going to, there's no sense of stakes whatsoever. So your point about the prophet here is well said, but I think it expands to a larger degree in that I never felt like he's in the dark alone after exploring a house so carefully. And he puts, earbuds in both of his ears and cranks up the volume. Now what?
Well, he can smell. If anybody's creeping up, right. He can smell them.
He can smell the mouse.
But he can't smell traps on the porch.
Well, but that's Dingus, I think, part of it being the characters are very comic booky. He's a Superman. He's a superhero. Nobody's ever going to touch him. You know, it's only when the movie's ready for him to be gut shot is there going to be any danger of that happening. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, that's part of why it sort of felt comic booky to me is those low stakes. Yeah.
But I can't stand that. And is this from a comic book? I don't know what the original property was.
No.
Is it a comic book?
No, it's an original story.
Okay. But there's that moment after he escapes the think about it room. We don't know how he escapes. He just has magically escaped it. He's gone back to get his iPod, and then he just saunters out of the store into the daylight. There's never any sense for me of where the danger is lurking other than when it's supposed to come in the next beat. That I know that the music will let me know when the danger's coming. I don't have a sense that he is as survival oriented as he's supposed to be. He'll light a fire whenever he feels like it. Sometimes he'll leave his arrows, sometimes he won't. There are little touches that miss for me. All of those things that I think would be an attention to detail that this character should have. And your point about the prophet, I think is well made, but I think it expands to the movie entire.
Right. Well, that's, I think the movie, I mean, part of, I don't mean to be dismissive when I say comic booky, but part of what I lean towards when I say that is it's more about images and concepts than rules or narrative or character development. And that doesn't have to be an insult. In this case, because I really liked the potential of the basic concept, I was disappointed that it leaned towards the comic booky instead of some cool things they could have done with narrative or character development or details like you're talking about. But I don't think so. Yeah. So, you know, he lights a fire in an abandoned nuclear cooling tower because it looks good. You know, that's the sort of the comic booky bit of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then there's no sense during that scene. And this is something that that I learned a while ago, that there's no sense during that scene that he's giving a monologue that's going to be interrupted. There's no sense that they're going to be discovered at all. We just know we're doing a scene, and the scene will start here and the scene will end there. The directors have not built anything into this scene that gives us any sense that there is a chance of danger, that they've lit a fire in the middle of the night and they're being tracked by people, and they know they're being tracked by people. And they sit there and they have their scene, and he gives a long monologue. He knows he's not going to be interrupted as he gives the monologue, and you can tell. And then he puts earbuds in both his ears and he goes to sleep. How does a person who's on the run, I mean, just contrast this with even though I didn't like it, with how Viggo Mortensen acts in The Road and how careful he has to be to make sure everything is taken care of before they do anything, or Zombieland for that matter, or Carriers when they light the fire and then they have to put it out. There's no sense that there's anything that's going to impinge on this scene other than what is going to happen at the next directorial break.
Is that mandatory for you, Dingus? Like, do you feel that a movie can work without that sense of danger?
Not this type of movie. He should be in constant danger.
Okay.
And that's what the stakes should be. And I should feel that Mila Kunis, who we haven't gotten to this yet, but is horrible, I think,
yeah,
in this movie. There's no sense when she's attacked that anything bad's going to happen to her. You know he's going to save her. There's no sense of that at all. And the movie has this wonderful sort of bold moment when he comes upon the travelers being attacked, and he says over and over to himself, stay on the path. This isn't your concern. Stay on the path. This isn't your concern. And the movie is bold enough to just let that go and not have him just descend on them and attack them all. It doesn't stay long enough on that scene to make us uncomfortable, but you know that he's done that and he's let those people be killed and that woman be raped. And so, okay, we've moved on from this, but there's no sense when Mila Kunis is attacked that she's
he's
in
thinking that, danger. Yeah.
You know that he's going to save her. You know that time and again, because
right,
everything is casual about this, just like the fireside scene I'm talking about.
Right.
You don't think that's necessary?
I don't think in a way that I don't think that that's what it was going for. I mean, it's why I sort of talk, and I wish I could think of a better adjective than comic booky, but you know, I think the movie is about a Superman of sorts. And I agree, Dingus, that it's weak character development, that you see him allowing someone be raped, and then for no reason that's really been developed or explained, he changes his mind because he's now with an actress who has lead billing.
Yeah.
But I don't think it necessarily needs that sense of danger you're talking about. Just like I don't think it needs to tie into the idea of what prophets were really like. That's something that I wish that it had. And so I hear you saying that with the danger, but I think there's room to make a comic book movie about a superhuman guy who can't be scratched or touched. And I just wish I don't think that doesn't excuse poor decisions like him saving Mila Kunis because she's got lead billing. But I don't think it's necessary. It's just something that I wish could have been done with it. I mean, I'm just disappointed that more things weren't done with this concept and these characters. So I agree with you, Dingus, that the sense of danger could have lent a lot more weight to the movie. And it's just one of the many things the movie didn't do that I thought made it disappointing.
Wait a minute, Tom. I don't understand here. You're saying that a character who has that level of invincibility is more interesting. But that's why Superman is so uninteresting to me. And
well, but obviously, no, Dingus, you can't. I mean, Superman and James Bond, for instance, nothing's going to happen to them, but they're obviously interesting to some people. I mean, they're still good. They're valid properties to tell a story about. You don't need to have a sense of danger to your character. I agree with you, Dingus. It would have lent this movie something that it needed. A much, much better weight, but I don't think it's necessary. James Bond and Superman are never going to get hurt. They're never going to die. You know,
but it's how they get out of stuff that makes it compelling.
But Eli shouldn't know that. Eli shouldn't know he's Superman. He shouldn't know he's invincible.
He has faith.
See,
he is invincible.
That's a good point, like Kelly Wand. And another facile understanding this movie has about the Bible and religion is that faith doesn't mean you know nothing is going to happen. Faith does not necessarily have to be diametrically opposed to doubt. And that's what this movie thought of as faith, is that he knows he's not going to be hurt. I mean, there was never any doubt. His understanding of faith was, I'm going to go this way. Nothing's going to hurt me. I'm going to deliver the Bible. I mean, I just thought that was another sort of weakness. And I forget, what was your question, Dingus? I was going to address something you said.
No, go ahead. I can't accept that a sense of stakes and danger, given what he is supposed to be protecting, and the two things he ends up having to protect, isn't more valuable than a character thinking he's invincible. Otherwise, let's just walk west and not stop anywhere, because he's not going to need water, he's not going to need food, he's not going to need anything. He doesn't have to interface with anybody, so just walk across the country and don't talk to anybody. I mean, a character not having obstacles, is not a story. I mean, I don't understand what you're saying, and I'm really lost here.
I'm saying that I don't think you need to have the character be put. You can have superhuman characters like Eli in this movie, who are still interesting and who still have to make tough choices and can still be vulnerable to things. I don't think that I just don't have that problem that you have about the low stakes. Like, I knew going in, once you see that silhouette battle under the overpass where he chops the guy's hand off, you know nobody is ever going to beat him in a fair fight. That's fine. That's the movie right there establishing a very simple rule, is this guy can beat odds. He's fine. You know, he's a Superman. And I was okay with that. I didn't necessarily see that as a flaw.
Unless he stashes his Bible behind a television, then he can be hurt.
Yeah, which he found because, you know, he can smell a television.
Why didn't you just keep it on him, man? And then...
No. I think the distinction I'm trying to make is that it's fine if we know that as an audience. It's not fine if he knows that and acts like that.
Because why?
I think that he's being lazy. And I think that's laziness when he's lighting – because he's being careful in other ways and just – and in small touches, they're just not being careful. Otherwise, he doesn't have to sit there with a gas mask. Again, I wanted to ask, why does he have a gas mask?
Yeah, he never uses it again. He just uses
He doesn't have to kill cats. He doesn't have to do anything. I mean, he shouldn't know, even though we feel that he is invincible, if that is what we're supposed to feel. He's still being careful, and he should be careful all the way around. And I think little moments like that fire and that scene being so slapdash and casual are laziness, and they're not an example of what you're talking about. I disagree.
Well, there's the old proverb of, you know, trust in God, but tie your camel tight. And that's what he was doing.
Right. What?
That's what he was doing. I mean, he knew that he had this mission, that he was invulnerable, but he was still covering his bases. You know, he was still having to, like, eat cat and hunt and whatnot.
Can we get back to Mila Kunis just for a second?
Yeah, let's go.
By the way, I have a theory. I have a theory about why he was wearing the gas mask in the opening scene.
The forest.
Good. Help me out with that.
Because my guess, and I'm just guessing this, is that they shot that scene later and they didn't have Denzel Washington for it.
Huh.
I don't know. Did
that
he ever?
Can't be true.
Does he take the gas mask off in that scene?
No.
Well, that's my theory. There you go. Anytime you don't see the actor's face, I think it's for a reason, especially if it's throughout the entire scene. I think it's because the actor's not there. If Denzel Washington had been there, I'm convinced the Hughes brothers
would have. But he eats the cat later, so they had him for the cat eating day.
Ah, good point. Well, in that case, that's yeah, why not?
They just went, you don't have to come in today, because we're
sure. He had that day off. Okay, Mila Kunis, did you think she was good, Kelly Wand?
No, she kept throwing me out of the movie more than any other character.
So you're saying she looked, she really belonged in that milieu?
Oh, yeah. She was too comic booky.
She really did. It was sort of like, are you supposed to be in this movie, Mila? Right. Should you, are you really? They're casting you? Really? Okay.
It really became like The Road 90210 when she was in it.
How about when she was all
pants and boots?
Yeah. And how about.
She's at the Galleria.
And when she got gussied up at the end to go out and, I guess, carry the Bible back.
Yeah, now she can fight all of a sudden, which means she must be blind, too.
Oh,
I have to tell you, everybody in my theater was laughing at that. And they were also laughing after the shootout when she peeks around the corner in these huge sunglasses and pulls them down. Everybody started giggling at that, too. She was totally giggle-worthy. And in that long scene in the Think About It room where she's supposed to be seducing him, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It was interminable.
It really was, wasn't it? Well, and that's another thing, too, where the editing, there would be scenes like that where they would cut out to another scene that didn't seem like it was really supposed to be at a simultaneous time, but it felt like the Hughes brothers really needed to chop up some of the scenes because otherwise they were too long and dull. I mean, there was editing in here that I was like, wow, you guys really got stuck with some, like, long, weak scenes, didn't you?
He got to San Francisco on foot before the – old man.
Yes, exactly. It was that kind of thing. Right.
With his gangrenous leg.
Even the editing and that whole reveal switcheroo final thing was hammy. Was totally wrong. The editing just was totally off in this movie.
Well, the Hughes Brothers' last movie was From Hell, and that was...
I like that movie. I'm a huge From Hell apologist.
Now, I don't remember it, but that
was
like...
what was it called?
That was like 6 years ago, wasn't it, Kelly Wand?
It was 9 years ago.
Wow. And was it good?
They were desperate for this.
I don't remember...
Well, compared to other Alan Moore adaptations, depending on how you feel about Watchmen.
Oh, I didn't know that was a...
But it's way better than League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, for God's sake. And it's interesting. Johnny Depp plays like an opium fiend, and Heather Graham's one of the prostitutes.
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah, I remember that part.
Ian Holmes in it, remember? With his dilated pupils. I like that movie. I don't understand why I get such a bad rap, personally.
Do you think that the Hughes brothers did a good job as directors? Like, because I watched this movie, and I'm like, these guys really aren't sure how to shoot or cut a scene or pace a movie. Like, I didn't get the sense that I just was really disappointed in what they did. Was there any of that in From Hell, or did From Hell seem pretty polished?
There was less, but there was less action in From Hell.
Okay.
So they could just devote their attention to atmospheric stuff, which is also those are the best parts of Book of Eli, is when it's actually evoking the time period or a sense of waste and desolation. The road parts were the best parts.
I think it's fairly, but it really did look to me like it wanted to be...
Picture Kunis in the road. You know what I mean?
But it really did look to me like it wanted to be an action movie. And that's one reason that I kind of take issue with Dingus's thing about the stakes and stuff, is it really just wanted to do cool fight scenes, a cool shootout with...
It wanted it both. It wanted its cake and...
I kept thinking that I wanted less of that. You know, when the Gatling gun and the RPG get pulled out, I just got sad.
I hated
my overwhelming feeling.
He has
was
a bunch of stuff under the
to say nothing of how horrid that George and Martha scene is. That when the Gatling gun and the RPG comes out, it just made me sad.
Oh, I agree, Dingus. I mean, I agree that stuff was
trying. You know, you're using an RPG when you're trying to protect the book that is most important to you in the world, really,
and the girl you.
And you're doing it from about 30 feet away, too.
And I just kept feeling like we want a scalpel, and you can't even find a hatchet, so you're just going to just dynamite these people over and over again. And I wanted more subtlety. I wanted less Gary Oldman chewing scenery and screaming, and I wanted more quiet menace from a character. I thought even Gary Oldman, who I love, was horrible or just was poorly cast. And so you saying this is illuminating to me, Tom, because I guess I should have looked at it more as an action film. But even in the action scenes, you referenced that first dark fight under the underpass, where I wonder why do we have to be in darkness? And then in the bar, when there's this awesome fight going on and we keep going around and the camera's on a carousel or a merry-go-round, and I just want to have a Busby Berkeley shot where I can see the whole fight and just watch the fight happen and develop and be visceral and awesome. And instead, we're just moving everywhere and constantly moving and smacking things.
Well, and that's Dingus. I hated – that's what I – more than Michael Gambon having a bunch of guns in the couch, more than the Gatling gun rolling out of the back of the armored car, more than Ray Stevenson standing in the front yard shooting a rocket into the window – I hated in that scene the camera work. I was like, get your freaking camera out of my action sequence. Don't go flying in and out of bullet holes and whipping around. I don't need that. You've got an action sequence. I don't want your camera in the middle of the shootout. Thank you very much. So I agree with you, Dingus. Like a lot of those stylistic choices I felt were poor. The underpass scene, I kind of understood because it was one long shot and it was silhouette. And that was very much what I understand you would expect in a comic book. Like that seemed very comic booky. Like, so I could understand that a bit, and I started losing faith in the action set pieces as the movie progressed. And by the time the camera was flying through bullet holes, I was like, oh my God, stop with that already. And that's another reason that I did feel the pacing was weird. Is it they seem to be really in love with these over the top crazy action sequences. And then, Kelly, you're talking about how effective those The Road scenes were, and some of them were good. You know, I loved Denzel Washington looking all grizzled, and he looked, instead of more like Mad Max, at times he looked a little homeless. And, you know, that was kind of this cool sad imagery. I loved some of that.
And the opening's really quiet, and there's not much talking, and it's him just fumbling around stuff and looking for water. And it's the best scene. It's a great sequence.
Well, and it leads up to that's part of what makes the discussion with Tom Waits so great. Finally he takes off his sunglasses and he's talking to a person. I mean, that's a good 20-minute bit of the movie right there.
He's actually haggling in that scene. Like he can be challenged because Tom Waits is like, nah, I don't want any of that stuff.
Ah, good point. Yeah.
You're right, Kelly. And I wanted that.
Oh, give him all the water he wants. He has a
That's his biggest obstacle.
Anything on the top shelf is his.
You're right, Kelly. I wanted this film to be more laconic instead of so much yelling and screaming.
It started out that way.
It started out that way, and it felt good when it was doing that. And then it started to lose. It lost some of that. And going off of that, I think I can blame the directors for this. There was far too much vitality and life in the people that were in this world. You look at that cart girl who I really liked what that actor was doing, but she's voluptuous beyond belief when she should be completely emaciated. And they're all incredibly healthy people. And they try to justify it in the town by saying we have all this food and water. But that's not what this world should look like. And Denzel Washington, I thought, was great. I thought he kind of carried that through when he was alone. I had a feeling that he was building this world. And then when he got into the town or got among other people, it was just betraying him for things that looked cool and people that looked pretty.
Can I make a confession about the girl on
the
cart
scene?
Because
the Bible likes hot people. Yes, please.
Can I make a confession about the girl in the shopping cart? So she's on the ground and she's got her legs folded up under her. I thought that they were having...
Legless.
I thought her legs had been severed at the knee, and I was like, oh, that's kind of gross and creepy and cool. And then she gets up and unfolds her legs, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm a weird pervert. I thought this was some amputee.
She was the perfect woman to you for a moment.
How dare you? But did you guys think that too, that she was like an amputee, or that was just
no,
me? Because she had her legs folded, and you could just see her knees, and I was like, wow, is that CG? Is that really a woman without legs? And no, she was just like sitting on her legs.
There was something else I was aware of in that scene on her body, but not her legs.
Was it her hair? Because she didn't have the perfectly shampooed hair. Is that what you're talking about?
That was it. It was the shampoo. Yeah,
perfect
right.
Legs. Perfect post-apocalyptic legs.
Okay, so you guys didn't care for Gary Oldman, I take it.
Well, I did. I don't know how you guys
thought. He's playing the same guy he always plays. So I don't know.
He was totally wrong. He was screaming when he shouldn't have been screaming. I thought he should have just been quiet menace, and I think he was totally wrong for this.
The early scenes, his pre-screaming scenes, Dingus, I totally agree, and he could have sustained that character on that tone throughout the movie. That was all it needed. Yeah,
it turns out to be incompetent, so then you go, oh, he's a crappy villain.
Yeah. Jennifer Beals, did you guys like her?
Yeah, she was great.
Yeah, she was fine.
She stole that scene.
I agree.
She's really good, and she never gets enough work, I decided.
Did you see Roger Dodger, Kelly Wand?
No, I will now.
Dingus, do you remember her from Roger Dodger?
Of course, yeah.
She was so good in that, yeah.
So no, I really liked her because you got a sense from her of fear and danger in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Even in that shampoo scene early, when I'm like, well, he's being nice to her and loving her. There's something on her face. There's something on her face that says she's loving this and it's pleasurable to her, but she's afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a sense of danger from her, even if you don't get it in other ways. So I liked her.
And she looks a little bit like Kunis, so they kind of made a good.
Yeah, that worked. That worked. What about the – did you say his name already, the guy who was the main henchman?
Ray Stevenson. Isn't that his name? Yes.
Is
that the guy from Rambo?
I know him he's from that HBO series Rome. I don't think, was he in the Rambo?
Oh, right. He's good.
Fine. I just didn't understand why whenever he had a chance to stop somebody, he just decided not to.
And then never got any consequences for it.
No, he doesn't shoot him. He just walks away. We don't.
I thought he tried to shoot him a couple times, and then he went.
He does, but given his face off, he just decides, well, I'm not going to shoot you after all.
I think he gives up. Yeah, he's like, I'm not going to hit him anyway. So that was weird, Dingus. That was so.
And then
odd.
In the car with her, he just gets out and gets on his knees. There's no. Somebody just told me I had to do this. My job is to do these two things, and I just did. But I am going to shoot an RPG into the house. I'll do that.
And how does he manage to get that huge kukri, that big knife, thrust hilt deep into his sternum from the car rolling over? They make a point of showing it, you know, laid on the dashboard. And then the car rolls over, and at some point, you know, still sitting in the seat, the thing goes perpendicular and thrusts up to the hilt into his chest.
Why pull it out?
She's done it. The idea is that somehow in the tumbling of this car, because she sees it, that she's killed everybody in the car.
No, Dingus, are you serious?
I thought he fell
on it, or it somehow in the rough and tumble, like, plunged into his chest. So you think that's what they were going for, that Mila Kunis stabbed him?
Yeah, because she looks
they
at it.
There's a
meaningful moment where she sees it, and that's that whole, you know, Chekhov's gun kind of thing, where he takes it and he goes, ha, 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 and he puts it on the sideboard or wherever he puts it, and she sees it, and it's like, ah. And then she decides to choke the dude. And I think that otherwise he just gets a paper cut, and after the wreck, he's like, ow, my finger, look.
I can't decide which is more clumsy, that it managed to fly off of the dashboard and plunge into his chest, or that she at some point reached over there and stabbed him.
Oh, God did it.
I choose to think that she did it, because it's more interesting to have somebody make a decision and do something than have something happen.
You wouldn't have that character who you're about to set up as an awesome fighter for the last shot. She would show.
I mean, look at the way she runs in this movie. The way she runs in this movie drove me nuts.
Like
she has this
girl.
little prancing hot girl, high heels run. And
if she'd been Legolas, it would have been interesting. And then he takes along this cripple with him.
Well, think about how they could have cast that part more interestingly. Because I think she's and I've liked her in stuff recently. I mean, I liked her in a couple things recently.
I think she was just miscast, so I don't.
She's horribly miscast, and I would like to think of how you make that part more powerful. Do you go younger? Do you go older? How do you do it?
Right. You go less hot, and then he's not even responding to the hotness, which makes
sense. Well, he can't.
Oh, good point. He has no idea how hot she is.
No, he can smell how hot she is. As can I.
But honestly, how do you cast that part to make it more interesting? Because I think that that's really a key for me. If you can have an actress in the room with him that's more interesting and better able to match what Denzel Washington is doing.
I think
one of the things I like about the twist at the end, and I really had to think hard about this because it kind of pissed me off, is I have to think back over the course of the film and how hard Denzel Washington worked to make this work. I mean, he does a lot of work in this movie. I think if you really look at his performance,
he learned kung fu for it. Did you know that?
It's not only that, he has to work very hard so that when I look back over it, I don't see him seeing things. But he can't give that away in any way. The way, like Tom said earlier, Jennifer Beals gives away when she walks into the room. So that's a lot of work. That's hard. What he's doing, and I have a tremendous amount of admiration for that. What he's doing is very, very difficult, you know, I think, over the course of this film. And I'm impressed with that. I think it's ultimately it ruins the film in a way, because I think that it's a more interesting story if he doesn't have to do that. But it is fascinating to me the amount of work he had to do. And I'm wondering, like, how do you match that with a character that's more interesting, and who do you cast?
Yeah.
Tom, what's your answer?
I think they should have gotten Cody Smith McPhee from The Road.
I'm glad you brought up The Road, actually, because I did want to say that I think The Road, with as few people who have seen it, really steals a lot of the thunder from this film visually, as far as all of the overpasses is concerned.
There were those road scenes, definitely. Yeah.
And all I kept thinking was how the tone of The Road, at least as much as I didn't like it, at least the tone of The Road seemed mostly consistent. You didn't have this weird George and Martha scene cropping up that ruined it.
Poor Michael Gambon. How do you waste Michael Gambon?
And Malcolm McDowell.
You know, Malcolm McDowell's a big old goofball, and that, God bless him, that's fine. You know, at that point in the movie, I was like, you know what? Good for you, Malcolm. Show up. This movie's sort of beyond hope at this point.
Dude, anyway.
Show up and collect your check. and they put that goofy wig on him. I was like, you know what? Fine. Go ahead. Be the crazy professor at the end of the movie. That's fine. That, all of that stuff at the end,
this
I hate it.
This baby hits 88. You're going to see some serious shit, though.
I don't know what that is, but I
terrible.
Was it from Repo Man?
Repo Men.
I hated all that stuff at the end of the movie. It so did not need to drag on that long and show us his, you know, his gravestone and the silly Milo Kunis kitted out to go back into the wasteland. All of that was just terrible.
You're absolutely right, Tom. Do you know where the movie actually ends?
Where?
My opinion is the last shot of the movie has to be the shot of his eyes. I mean, if you're going to
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, right, yeah. It's kind of like, you know what, here's the twist, and now we're going to play you out with 10 minutes of sappy stuff. Yeah,
the last shot should be her eyes. It's like she's blind, too, and that's the twist.
well, there is this lovely moment, and this is another thing I loved about Jennifer Beals, when she puts her fingers on the Bible and her face lights up.
What part was she reading? That's what I wondered.
A Song of Solomon.
Lord's Prayer again, or.
And that was something I thought was really missing from Gary Oldman when he actually gets the book in his possession. And what I thought about immediately was the moment where Belloc opens the Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he's so filled with joy.
For half
and,
a second, for his face fell.
Exactly. But he's reverent.
Like Gollum with the ring, too.
Yeah, he's got an understanding of what he has in his hands. And Gary Oldman didn't bother to endow this thing that he has in his hands. It might as well have been a brick as far as he was concerned, the way he was handling it and dealing with it. I never got the sense that there was this moment of revelation for him. No matter what he believes, what his faith is, he understands it is of great power. And he never treats it that way.
Well, he told Tom Waits to be careful. What more do you want?
If he was book lover, he would have learned Braille.
I want Belloc. I want to see Belloc's face and Jennifer Beals' face. Do you know what I'm saying when she puts her hands in the Bible and her face?
No, I know. But that's for a different movie. I mean, this was a comic booky action movie, and I
stop saying that.
But it's true, Dingus.
Talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is a comic book action movie that has those little touches.
You're good. No, that's right.
Like when they go out to when Mila Kunis goes out to get the water, and they're pouring water out of this pump. And the guy's not being careful about little drops. And I think about Dune, how they would save every little drop. Or how the arrows are left just so we can see this cool tableau of arrows sticking out of the guy's crotch, which made me think of your little – the woman getting shot through her breast with the arrow, by the way. But Eli would take those arrows with him.
Right.
There are so many little touches that they just – come on. Just
you know what? That's a very fair point, Dingus. Me talking about it being an action movie and a comic booky movie, that is not at all an excuse for some of those lazy things. So you're right. I think I totally agree. Yep. Wow. All right. What did you guys think of that?
Say something dumb?
What did you guys think of that awesome bit? So here was a cool thing that I'll bet you guys didn't notice. Did you notice when he was in his little think about it room, the poster on the wall?
Yeah.
A boy and his dog.
One, two, three, not only you and me, got 180 degrees and I'm caught in between. Counting one, two, three, feet apart and they're free, getting down with 3 feet.
This week's 3x3. Brought to you
that
by,
wasn't too bad, right?
It's totally manufactured.
Gary would just love it.
Yeah. This week's 3x3 are movies that make great use of weather. The examples I gave are A Serious Man, which I don't want to go too much into it, but that's a movie that makes great use of weather. A movie that makes terrible use of weather is the long dull story of Benjamin Button, or whatever that movie was called.
Aha, you saw Benjamin Button.
Shut up.
Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Curious Case, yeah, the long, curious, dull case of
the long
Benjamin,
movie of
Benjamin Brett.
So I want three movies from you that make great use of weather. That's beyond that. You can game this however you like. Kelly Wan, since you will be introducing next week's 3x3, you go first. What is your number three movie that makes great use of weather?
My number three movie that makes great use of weather is a movie I'm sure you guys haven't seen because it was made before 2010. It's called a little thing called Lawrence of Arabia.
When did they use weather in that?
Yeah. Anyway, directed by David Lean, whose movies I know you've never seen.
Or the remake is going to be called Larry, by the way, with an exclamation mark.
Larabia. Sounds dirty. Written by Robert Bolt. I remember seeing this at a re-release. I almost said revival, but I didn't. That would have been totally misleading. But air conditioning was totally jacked up, but everyone was still sweating because the cinematography was so evocative. Lawrence of Arabia. The end.
Now, is that weather, Kelly Wand, or is that scenery?
It counts as – well, I hope it counts as weather because my number two is a little iffy.
All right, okay.
I hope you're counting my number three, giving me a free pass on Lawrence of Arabia. How does that not count as weather? How does a movie about a desert not count as weather? I guess movie about any geography that counts as weather, so you're right.
Well, but you're right. Open.
It's about the sun. It's about
– Right. No, you're right. I mean, it's so – that's such a huge part. The climate is such a huge part of what makes that movie work.
You have seen it.
Oh, of course. Please. I'm not that remiss in my duties. I've seen Lawrence of Arabia a couple times. I've seen Lawrence of Arabia on a big old huge I've not just rented it. I've seen it on
actual.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a must see big screen experience.
Although I have to say I think it's overrated.
No, it's good. You're dumb.
Well, I say that just because I get fidgety watching Lawrence of Arabia, and
it's because it's about a conflict that you. No, not too many people can wrap their brains around because it's about Turks versus Arabs, and you don't even know why they're fighting, probably.
Right.
It's a big comic book action-y movie. That's why
The stakes, there were no stakes in that. I always felt like, you know.
It's also a biopic. But, that being said, Omar Sharif kicks ass in it, and it's a character piece. It's about a guy who's got little nuts.
And it's also one of the few movies that really presents male rape in a sensitive light.
Yeah.
Like Deliverance.
Tom uses it every night to get to sleep. And Jose Ferrer, I believe, is the one who licks his lips salaciously.
Are you serious? He's the Turkish interrogator?
Yeah.
That's Jose Ferrer? Wow.
So taps into your homophobic fears of Jose
Ferrer. Jose Ferrer. I wondered where that came from.
You don't like that movie? You think it's overrated?
No, I'm kidding. No, I think it's wonderful, but it's one of those long, epic chore movies in a way. Some movies are tougher to watch than others, and that's just a fairly difficult one for me to say.
I thought you'd like it because it shows him dying in the first scene, kind of like
spoiler
on a motorcycle sidecar.
No, that's good, and that's a
Michael Clayton kind of movie,
desert movie. Yeah, all right, and you know it's never even more impressive to me, Kelly Wand, than the desert scenery is a young Peter O'Toole. I mean, he's just so amazing in that movie.
Yeah,
like his eyes glittering and how young he looks. I mean, Peter O'Toole who's not a fan of Peter O'Toole, but I knew him as the older guy and then went back to see him. And was that his first movie? Like, did David Lean?
That was his breakthrough movie.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's just,
and you can totally believe him as a leader of men and a leader of like men of another nation just because he's so.
And also, like, it's so much about, like, that character does have so much like doubt and insecurity and obstacles. I mean, that,
And he looks like a desert. He has like those icy, you know, like ice desert. Desert colored hair. I'm a pretty careful movie viewer.
Speaking of icy, Dingus, what's your number three weather related, great use of weather in a movie?
Icy. Nice segue. Is that a spoiler?
For I don't know. I'm assuming somebody's going to have something with something cold in one of their picks.
Spoilers.
Yeah, I did The Heat Miser. Oops. All right, my number three movie with great use of weather is going to make you both groan, and I can't wait. So I'm going to give you a quote. How about that?
Yes, go. Awesome.
Always,
I love this.
Always better than the real thing.
Our next weather report will be in 4 days.
Huh. Broadcast news.
Nope.
LA Story. One.
That's a quote.
Yeah, there you go. Tom got it.
Wait, you know why I got it, Dingus? Because it's my number three, you jerk.
No, it isn't.
It is. It says right here, my number three is L.A. Story.
You've never even seen L.A.
Clark as a weatherman in Los Angeles. The inherent absurdity of it, with him taping the weather broadcasts a week in advance. It was a minor touch, but it really addressed the central fact about Los Angeles. There is no weather here. Thank you. Those are my notes for my number three.
Huh. You're such a jerk.
Can you read the rest of my notes, please?
You are such a jerk.
It also has an earthquake, which counts as weather.
Right? It does. It has a great little earthquake.
Oh, you're such a jerk.
Hell, Ace. Sorry. I think that movie's a little overrated.
I'm not. Well, that's the thing, is I wasn't a huge fan of it. It was cute, whatever. But I just remember really enjoying
romantic comedy.
I just remember enjoying their take on the idea of a weatherman in Los Angeles and how Los Angeles has no weather. So I'm sorry, Dingus, did your notes have anything beyond that, or did I cover it all?
No, but beyond that, I like how it and this is where I'll deviate from what you're talking about. I liked the sort of magic, romantic quality to the
movie. Turns out he can control the weather at the end, so that's how he gets the girl.
It's this weird magic thing that happens with these ridiculous signs he's reading on the freeway. And there's this great use of this Enya song, Exile, which I know I shouldn't like, but it moves me every time. I don't know that the movie's that good, but I like it a lot. I don't think it holds up. Let me be honest. The thing I like about it is that she can't leave on her plane because it's raining.
Yeah.
And this is Los Angeles. And when I first got to Los Angeles, and the first time there was a major rain, I had to go to an acting class, and I was about an hour and a half late for it because the traffic was horrid. And I got there, and I had moved from Virginia, and I honestly didn't understand why the traffic was so bad. I didn't link what was going on with the weather to the traffic because it was just rain. And I got to my acting class and I said, I don't know what it is, but the traffic is crazy out there. And the other actors looked at me like I was crazy and said, it's raining. And the idea that rain would make that kind of impact and then that they would make that happen in this movie. And it's this wonderful, magical moment. And also, there's this great kiss. Their kiss in the rain is beautiful, as ridiculous as I think Steve Martin looks. He's wearing a ridiculous shirt.
What's wrong with his shirt? Why are you calling out Steve Martin's shirt?
I just think he looks goofy. But I loved Woody Harrelson in this. And Woody Harrelson is his boss at the weather station.
What?
And Woody Harrelson loses his yacht because Steve Martin has predicted the weather and taped it and then gone on a vacation. And Woody, I think Woody Harrelson is great in this movie. He has one of my favorite lines, which is more wacky, less egghead. This movie has a lot of great lines in it, and the use of weather is beautiful.
All right. Kelly Wand, what is your number two movie that makes great use of weather?
You weren't going to say anything. You read your notes. Okay.
Well, I got nothing else to add. No, shut up. I cannot believe you've already ripped off, and I'm afraid someone else is going to get my number one. Rats. God, I hate going last.
I predict I get your number one.
I really avoided the one I thought you would choose.
All right. Well, Kelly Wand, what's your number two? I'm sure someone's going to
say. My number two, tell me if this one counts or not, because this one I'm not sure.
Okay.
The movie Sunshine by Danny Boyle.
That's like celestial phenomenon. I don't know. Doesn't have
sun
to
sun counts as weather. It's sun.
Doesn't have to hit an atmosphere to be weather. Well, go ahead and explain. How is there weather in?
Because
in
the weather governs every major plot point in the movie, or at least sun related issues, solar heat issues, dust issues. Dust is weather. Greenhouse is weather. Don't get me started.
Great. My next one was going to be about climate. Now I can't do that.
And the whole reason they're doing it is because of the weather. They're going into the sun, dropping a bomb on it because there's issues on Earth, which you see at the end.
So you would say weather is the MacGuffin in Sunshine?
Yeah, I would. They should have just called it weather.
Now Kelly Wand.
Or number two on Kelly's list.
Kelly Wand, can you explain to Dingus why the third act of Sunshine does not make it a bad movie? Go.
It does.
Oh, for Pete's sake. Okay, you're going to...
Kelly jumps the shark. But...
Oh, you guys are terrible.
Because the computer would have known when that guy got on board.
Whatever. I'm not talking to either of you.
How come that ship's computer's dumber than Seth Brundle's computer? Which knows whether the fly is... Well, I guess that's a dumb one. That example. Disregard. Actually, that's probably the stupidest computer in the history of movies. So.
That's a great 3x3. Stupid computers.
Wait, you're an apologist of the third act of Sunshine?
I am, yes. Here's my deal.
That stuns me.
Hold on, let me explain. I'm so fond of Sunshine. I
love
But I think that the fact that some people, I think the common complaint, which I understand, is that it becomes a slasher film. You know, we have it's a monster there.
Yeah.
That we have a monster there who's kind of superhuman, and it makes it a different kind of movie. Is that we've started out with this really cool morality fable about what to do with the end of the earth and
what a survival horror.
Right. Well, but so for me, what they're facing constantly throughout the mission are each other's weaknesses and the decisions they have to make about the mission. But yeah, the final obstacle they face, I don't think of as necessarily a slasher, even though that's how he's presented as the unstoppable killer.
Well, it's so much a bad slasher movie too. It's all this like jitter, because if they show the dude, it'll look so crappy that they just keep cutting away from it. So you're conscious of them cutting away from a potentially lame movie ruining makeup effect. Okay, what were we going to say? Sorry.
Well, I don't think that he's so much a slasher, and this ties a little bit into what I think you're talking about, Kelly, with how he's shot. He's not so much a monster or a slasher so much as, to me, a specter, a sort of an incarnation of their previous failure. You know, they've tried to do this before. They have failed. The very last thing they have to overcome is failure, you know, human failure. And I don't think I'm not trying to say he's imagined, like they're imagining him or he's any less real, but partly from the way he's shot, to me, it's just this idea that, okay, the very last obstacle is the fact that we can't do this, that we tried to do this before and it didn't work.
I don't like it when allegories and metaphors and whatnot take over established
okay.
rules.
Yep.
Because it starts out as an awesome science fiction.
Yep.
This is my problem with Book of Eli, too.
Hard sci-fi.
Hard
sci-fi that sort of decides to play by a different set of rules.
And it's a very movie thing to do. Like, if you read science fiction novels, like the good ones, they never do that. They never go, oh, yeah, it's God did it. That's what's going on. Spoiler.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a movie thing to do, and I don't think I mind it when I like the movie as much as I did Sunshine. And I don't know, maybe I'm just...
Sunshine has so many awesome grace notes. I'm saying awesome way too much. I gotta stop that. Prior to the part that you're apologizing for, that you can't hate Sunshine.
Yeah.
Unless you have a heart of stone.
Dingus
does. You can't. I do not hate Sunshine. I'm sad when the last act so thoroughly fails the first two acts. It just lets them down and
breaks the rules.
It's a betrayal.
The rules change as you get closer to the sun.
No, they should have set up then. They should say,
They do. The characters, they're going crazy as they get closer to the sun.
But they know they are, and the computer should be able to compensate.
Oh, that's the dumb computer for you.
You're going
great. Go, good one. Dingus, what is your number two great use of weather in a movie?
My number two great use of weather in a movie, I will give you a quote. How about that? How's that for a surprise?
Awesome. Go.
His pattern indicates two-dimensional thinking.
Wrath of Khan?
Yeah, baby.
There's no weather in Wrath. That's a Star Trek movie.
No, yeah, that's
movie.
A good one. I like Dingus.
Wait, there's weather in a Star Trek movie?
Yeah, the clouds. That's how he beats it.
Is that the one where they go back to San Francisco? They go back in time and there's whales in San Francisco?
That's number four. Also weather themed.
Is that the one where they meet God?
No, that's number four.
Is that the one where the babe
pig farmer? I sure know a lot about Star Trek.
Where the babe pig farmer invents the warp drive? Is that the one? I can't keep them straight.
It's Cromwell, huh?
Dingus, good lord, Wrath of Khan. Wait, I actually don't remember weather. So explain to me the weather in Wrath of Khan.
The moment you mentioned this category, two films came to mind, L.A. Story and Wrath of Khan. Without question, this movie immediately came to mind.
Kirk knows weather.
That's right, he does. And I couldn't help but think of the Battle of the Mataara Nebula. And that's because
what nebula? I'm sorry, what was that?
The Mataara Nebula.
Nerd.
Because do you even know what I'm talking about? The ship is disabled. It's and so they have to escape Khan's ship, and to make the battlefield. To make the playing field level, I should say, they go into this nebula, which is really a placeholder for a storm, because a lot of this movie is sort of a facile patterning after Moby Dick. And so they escape into this storm, and it's shot very much like a storm. It's as if they're in a space storm. There's lightning bolts, and they can't shoot sometimes. They can't use any of their ship's They can't lock on. They can't use their sensors.
They can't look it up.
Because of this storm they're in, and at one point the Enterprise shoots at the, I think it's the Regent. I don't remember the name of the ship. And there's a lightning strike that makes their phasers go off. So it's very much like they're in a storm. And I think of this film in a childish way, as linking with Moby Dick, because obviously I saw this film before. Well, not obviously. I read Moby Dick, I think in 84 or 1985. So I'd already seen Wrath of Khan, and Wrath of Khan cribs a lot from Moby Dick and tries to sort of play at being Moby Dick.
It quotes from it directly. Well, it's an homage.
Oh yeah, it quotes from it directly, and it quotes from something that Ahab says about storms, and the quote that Khan says is, "I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round Antares Maelstrom and round Perdition's flames before I give him up," which is a cribbing of a quote from Moby Dick. And so I was just into a new school.
Plus Kirk's white like Moby Dick.
Very good, very good. I was in a new school the first time I read Moby Dick, and I was a total dork in a new situation and felt very awkward. And we were assigned to read Moby Dick in my English class, and I dutifully read it, and I believe that I was the only one in the class that read it. And this was an advanced placement class, but the other kids had been together for a couple of years, and they knew you don't have to read these books. Just Cliff Notes it. And I found this out later on when somebody who liked me said, you know, Christian, we didn't really read all of Moby Dick. Nobody ever does. And I had read the whole book, and I liked it. I didn't understand all of it, but I liked it. And I aced this publisher's test the teacher gave us, and I was the only one in the class who did. Part of what made me really love the book was understanding some of it from the point of view of Wrath of Khan, which is kind of embarrassing. But I equate that Matara Nebula battle with being in a storm, and so I will use that as my weather choice.
You guys are talking about space weather now. If I'd known that, wow.
Yeah.
So a nebula is weather.
Well,
it's a storm. It's a nebulous storm. That's weather on a nebula-sized scale, Tom. All
right. I think it stands in a storm, and you made it wide open enough.
I know. I'm not crying foul. I'm just calling you a geek, a dork, a science fiction dork. So the Mintari Nebula, huh? All right. How about that?
The Murawski Nebula.
Wow, man, my list.
I love Moby Dick, by the way, and I don't know anyone else who's finished it. So I'm.
Oh please, we've all read Moby Dick here.
No, not too many people read it.
I
think most people would say it's not as – most people would call it overrated, but when I discovered it kind of late in
life. No one's going to call it overrated. Anybody who calls Moby Dick overrated, never take a book recommendation from them.
Remember that chapter about the whale skeleton?
I loved all those little descriptive chapters. Yeah.
That book is amazing.
I had a hard time in a lot of the blubber talk, but this is probably the fourth or fifth time you guys have
discussed
your
marriage out of this.
What the hell? This is the fourth or fifth time we've wet dingus?
You've discussed Moby Dick on this podcast, by the way.
We're all Moby Dick apologists here. All right, so Wrath of Khan, space weather. Okay, wow. Can't wait to hear y'all's number one. Empire Strikes Back. So.
Hobbs and Star Trek 4.
My number two is a remake, and I'm going to give you a line from it. Actually, no, I'm not. I don't think I can attempt that.
I don't know what that's from.
So the line is actually, it's Dennis Quaid setting a thug straight on the proper use of infer versus imply. I always loved that scene. Does that do it for you guys?
Get Shorty?
No. So there's a remake
Far From
of,
Heaven?
There's a remake of DOA, the Edmund O'Brien classic.
Oh yeah. Published
like that movie.
And it's Dennis Quaid. He's been poisoned, and he's got, I think, you know, 24 hours or whatever to discover who's poisoned him. He goes to the hospital, and they're like, sorry, you're dead in 24 hours. We can't do anything. So he super glues himself to Meg Ryan, and they run around New Orleans, and they try to solve the crime. And the cool thing about it, it doesn't pull any punches. You know, he dies at the end. So they don't do that thing where the character has a terminal illness, and then the movie changes its mind.
They would if they remade it now.
Right. So, but the cool thing, and I don't know if you guys remember this, I loved this detail of the movie, and the movie must have been, you know, 82 maybe, but it's set, I believe, in New Orleans, but at any rate, it's set at Christmas time during a heat wave. So you've got everybody set up with Christmas trees and there's Christmas decorations everywhere, but yet everyone's in shirt sleeves and sweating. It's this great disparity that I think sort of calls to mind, and I don't know if the original did this, by the way, but it calls to mind this idea of somebody's system, like a system out of whack, you know, this poison coursing through his body that's going to kill him, kind of reflected by, you know, yeah. The weather has gone
his body temperature.
So that's my number two, is the fact that DOA was Christmas time in New Orleans during a heat wave, and I loved seeing that. I loved the visual stuff they got out of that.
So it's where he hooked up with Meg Ryan in RL, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
And the first third of Dennis Quaid's New Orleans trilogy.
Big Easy.
Yeah.
With Ellen Barkin. Gosh. Uh-huh. Let's see. That's a Dingus, do you know what his other New Orleans? Inner Space.
Right.
Is that
Independence Day.
Independence Day is in New Orleans?
That's Randy.
No. Oh, never mind.
I confuse them too. They look so much alike. Yeah. Are they related?
Dingus knows.
Kelly Wand?
They're married, actually. Did you? I'm interested to find out what inspired you to take this category. Did you know DOA was going to be in going in?
You know, this category, I did not know DOA until about 15 minutes before we started recording.
Jeez.
I had the worst time with this category. My number one was the reason for picking it, and one of you jerks, I'm sure, is going to preempt me. But I had a really hard time with this one. I'll tell you, well, even my alternate list is terrible. Like, I put Weatherman on there just because I couldn't pick anything, which I love Weatherman, the Nicolas Cage movie, but it has nothing to do with weather.
I had a hard time calling it down. I had a lot of different.
Okay, well, we'll come to our alternates last. So Kelly Wand, what is your number one?
I'm going to do a quote from it because I never know quotes.
Okay.
This one I know quotes from. It's very obscure, so it may perplex you and our three listeners. Here's the quote. Ready? Real good, then.
That's a terrible quote. That's like something Dingus would do.
I don't know. That's the only quote I know from it.
What is that in response to?
Everything. Every other sentence in the movie.
Birdie.
Does this count as weather, by the way, this movie? My number one choice is Fargo.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay, Dingus, go.
Well, wait a minute. You've got to elaborate. So it's because it's like in a cold, snowy spot, or what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's a mirror reflection of the character's mental states, because it's always snowing like it is in their heads. When you shake their head, snow runs through it.
All right.
Like in their Upper Redford movie.
I thought of that, too, just because of that image of Steve Buscemi trying to scrape the ice. No, it's not Steve Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi, how dare you? William H. Macy.
Thank you. Trying to scrape the ice off.
Man versus Nature.
Yeah. And just ending up whacking the windshield.
Yeah, yeah. See, I think the weather's made them all nuts, and that's why things go so awry. And
you know what? That's actually...
They only hide the money because of the snow.
So Kelly Wand, that's actually a very good observation. Like, I like when you put it that way, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, good call. I like that.
Well, it takes me about 10 minutes to understand why I picked that.
Okay, good.
And that image of him putting the ice scraper, I think that's what he does, as a marker in the snow to try to find where he's buried the bags of money.
It's wire.
Yeah. Right, right.
Is it really the same ice scraper that he has the tantrum with earlier?
No. Two different characters.
Oh, Steve Buscemi. Now I'm confusing them. Right, of course.
Right. And I just love the way that that knowledge of burying something as a kid and thinking, I'm going to put a little twig here to find it again.
Right.
nobody's ever going to find that. I loved that.
Did y'all know Fargo is based on a true story? Therefore, that money is out there somewhere.
Yeah, some Japanese girl looked for it.
How'd she do? Did she find it?
No.
Wonder why. Dingus.
She find the scraper.
What is your number one pick for a movie that makes great use of weather?
All right, I'm going to use another quote. Sorry, guys. You ready?
Yep.
Listen, good luck in the rain. Do you guys want some garbage bags or something?
I think I've seen this. Luckily, nobody stole my number one pick, so that's the good news. Oh, gosh, this sounds so familiar. Can you give me another quote?
Before this scene, another character says, I think it's going to rain.
No, for Pete's sake.
Dumb and Dumber.
Oh, I've seen this, haven't I, Dingus? Is it recent?
It's in 2004, and the three main characters end up wearing garbage bags in the rain.
Maybe I haven't seen. I don't know. I give up. What is it?
And they stand on the edge of the infinite abyss and scream.
Oh. Okay.
Jacob's Ladder.
Garden State.
Garden State. Very good. I had a bunch of other choices, but I watched the scene again and I remembered why this movie moved me so much. And in addition to the fact that I didn't realize until I started watching the scene and had to put it on pause to go and take care of something with my little boy, that it's got one of my favorite music cues in this movie as well. This great, Only Living Boy in New York song, by Simon and Garfunkel. But there's this amazing scene in Garden State where the characters have been in this journey and they wind up at this junkyard on the end of, at the edge of this abyss, which is incidentally called Kiernan's Fault. And,
I thought that was a nebula.
Yeah. Going in, Natalie Portman, and I didn't really think about this until I started putting this together, was in, but that was probably, if not my favorite, one of my favorite performances that year, says, "I think it's going to rain." So rain plays an important part. It's not just people looking good in the rain, which is a distinction Tom made last week when he laid down this category, and I was very aware of this. They're in this boat house that's like an ark on the edge of this abyss, and the rain is just pervasive in the scene, and they're talking about it. And then they go out, and they, after this scene with these two extraordinary characters, they go out into the rain in garbage bags and have this moment where they're screaming and then have this amazing first kiss. And I'm a sucker for really good first kisses in movies, and I've had a couple of movies lately that have just tanked after really good first kisses. And I really liked the first kiss in Youth and Revolt, and then I felt the movie tanked for me. And I liked the first kiss in 500 Days of Summer too, and that movie really went south hard. And looking at this movie again made me just feel so good about what this type of movie should be, and how this type of movie can be done properly, where you can have this sort of quirkiness, but real characters in a real situation, and this moment where they're in the rain in these garbage bags having their first kiss, it knocked me out.
Very good. I like that one, Dingus. Well done. All right. Well, I am elated that nobody picked mine, because this is what inspired the category, and I'm like, one of these jerks is going to steal it. It's so obvious. But I see you guys were off doing your space weather stuff, so that gives me a lot of opportunity here. So this movie, we live in Los Angeles. There's no rain here. One of the things I miss about, I mean, there's rain, but it's not storms. It's nothing.
It's raining right now.
But I miss, in Arkansas, you would get these spectacular thunderstorms.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
As the thunderstorm is going away, you get this amazing, as the sun is starting to come out, there's a quality of light when it is strained through thunderclouds.
It's called a rainbow.
That is unmistakable. And it's not just a rainbow, it's the quality of light. I mean, it's light strained through water. It's one of the things that I love when I go diving. When light comes through water, it looks different. And this movie, this movie takes place over, I don't know, like 4 or 5 days, and each day has a title card. Every single day up until the end, it is raining. And I think the movie was shot in LA. I don't know if it's supposed to take place in LA, but they went to great pains to make every scene. And this director went on, by the way, he does amazing lighting. The way he lights his scenes is fantastic. So every scene in this movie, it is raining really hard. And even when you're indoors, there's that special light filtered through thunderstorms coming through the windows. And it is so vivid. And then on the final day of this movie, it stops raining. And that final day opens with that cold, hard post-rain light shining on Los Angeles. And then the movie moves out of the city into this wide open, sunny area. And the progression of weather in this movie is, I think, part of what makes it a fantastically, visually stunning movie. And the movie is Seven.
That was Blade Runner.
Well, Blade Runner does a lot of stuff with like night and special effects. I mean, Blade
it's
Runner
raining in Seven till the last scene. I totally remember that.
Throughout,
it's totally full of rain, but I totally thought 7 was supposed to be somewhere in the East. Like
maybe it is. Maybe it is. But wasn't it shot in L.A.? And I don't even know actually where it's supposed to take place. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it is New York. I mean, it certainly looks like there's the library scenes and the city stuff. But it's raining throughout 7.
Right,
Every single shot, even indoors, you see people outdoors with umbrellas. You see heavy rain falling. The chase scene, of course, has rain. And then the title card for the last day, when Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman are going into the police station, and you see a taxi cab pull up and feet step out of it, and it's Kevin Spacey as he walks over into the police station. That's the first non-rainy day you get. And then, of course, he goes in, he turns himself in, and then they take him out into the field where the what's in the box scene happens, and all that is in sunlight.
So the moral was, when Gwyneth Paltrow still has her head on, it makes it rain.
There you go. That's the scientific cause and effect.
Yeah. Man, I want to see 7 again. Did you watch
this? Yeah, me too.
You know what? I fast-forwarded through it to verify, because I wanted to say that even when they're indoors, you see that it's raining, and sure enough, every single shot where there's a window... you know, for instance, when they give Mark Boone Jr. the payment to look up the library records, you see in the background, it's raining, there's people going back and forth with umbrellas. Throughout the, you know, when they first show up at the first murder scene and Brad Pitt's carrying two coffees, you know, they're coming through the rain. The chase scene has rain. Everywhere you can see outside a window, it's raining outside.
Mark Boone Jr., the chubby Tom Waits.
That's true. I want to see a buddy movie where they play brothers.
And what I like is that I immediately think of them being in a car and having rainfall in the car, which is something I particularly love.
Yeah, the driving scenes. Like, there are scenes of them just driving, and it's through this torrential downpour.
Wait, rain counts as weather?
Only in space. What do you call space rain? Yeah. So good. I'm glad you guys didn't think of that. But that's my number one pick, just because Fincher's so meticulous about that. And I know I'm assuming it can't have been easy to do all that stuff. And that was his – oh, he did the Alien movie before 7, didn't he?
That's kind of a rainy movie. It's raining in
that
cargo.
Yeah. Tom, do you know what I can't believe you didn't pick? Can you guess?
Weatherman? No. Limbo? Grizzly Man? Whiteout? What?
Can't believe you didn't pick Magnolia. I thought for sure you'd pick that.
That's not weather. Frogs and nebula are not weather. God, you guys
frogs.
Are
you were clear.
I don't think a fantastic event like frogs falling out of the sky counts as weather.
What about a plague of locusts?
That is totally weather, and I thought that was what you were going for.
Oh, I'm not going to pick
Tom for not picking.
I'm not going to pick fake weather like you guys.
How do you think the frogs coming down happens? Because his quote is these things happen. Or this. How do you think that happens? That does happen. It happens because of the wind picks up
the frogs from a lake and carries them over the clouds and right.
It does happen. I thought that was totally why you picked this.
No.
And I avoided it.
I'm not going to cheat like that. I'm going to pick actual real-world weather, and I'm not going to pick the Minbari Nebula or the, you know, the solar flares from the sun. But no, Magnolia, that's – I guess you could have done that. I was seriously leaning toward – like I thought I was going to have to pick Grizzly Man, which is a documentary. That's not even a real movie.
All great movies have something to do with weather, where you remember the weather in them forever.
Okay. There was that – I don't want to get back into spoilers because people might have fast-forwarded, but there was the magical lightning bolt in Book of Eli.
You got to see that 3 times.
They wanted to make sure you didn't miss that. So you guys didn't see Whiteout, did you? The Kate Beckinsale mystery thing that said...
Yeah, she works in an office and she has to constantly erase people's mistakes.
Ah, very good. I like that angle.
That counts as weather.
That was set in the Antarctic and it was a sort of a potboiler mystery. It wasn't...
Oh, right. I remember that.
But the whole...
I don't want to see Kate Beckinsale wearing clothes.
You know Kelly Wand, that's funny, but the very first scene of it, of that movie, is her coming in from the, you know, the Antarctic cold, going straight to her quarters, stripping all her clothes off, stepping into the shower. And I was like, you guys are so shallow.
Smart.
You guys have to do that. So
you guys just talked me into watching this movie. 5 minutes.
But what they do is it's a murder mystery set in an Antarctic base, and a storm is coming in. So they've got to close the base down for the winter. And the last plane has to leave at a certain time of day. Now, if you don't get on that last plane, it's not a big deal. It just means that you're stuck in the base, which is on a skeleton crew, for 6 months. So it's not like it's going to be the end of the world or the base is going to be destroyed, but the countdown at the end of the movie just has to do with, you know, she really wants to get home and get out into the real world, and she has to decide whether or not, you know, she's going to miss this last plane and be stuck here for another 6 months. You know, it's nothing dire, but I liked that whole, like...
Wait, those are the stakes, and why not a six-month wait?
Well, yeah, she's so antsy about getting back into the real world that, you know, she gets drawn into this mystery of what's going on, and she has to decide, you know, do I stay and solve it and I'm stuck here for 6 months, or do I just let it be? It's not a thriller or anything.
Does she have to solve it in the shower?
She never takes her clothes off again after that first scene. Yeah. So I almost ended up having to pick that. Dingus, what else did you have?
That reminds me of 30 Days of Night for some reason.
Yeah. Now, 30 Days of Night, though, there was a storm, but they weren't evacuating the city or anything, were they? I don't know.
No, it's just the idea that you have to take the last whatever out, or you're stuck.
Yeah, or like the thing, you know, there's all kinds of great things you can do in the sort of cold weather settings with lockdowns and whatnot. Yeah. All right.
The thing. I suck. All right, changing my number one. It's the greatest film ever made. I didn't think it's one.
The most obvious one, and I only say this because I want to protect against people who mentioned The Jerk last time, would be Singing in the Rain, of course. I mean, that's a beautiful use of weather.
That's like an old movie, though. No one's seen that.
It's
about a guy dancing, too. And it's not real rain. It's studio rain, as opposed to The Thing, which has real snow in it. Real aliens.
The one I really was really on my list until the last possible minute was Henry V.
Upset that The Thing wasn't my number one.
But I couldn't remember the exact line I was looking for, because there's this wonderful moment where Kenneth Branagh is walking they're walking, and it's not the St. Crispin's Day speech, which is great because this is before you had people digitizing cold breath coming out of people's mouth, and you could see the steam coming out of their mouths, and when the herald rides up on his horse, you could see it coming out of the horse's mouth. But he says some line about, and I couldn't remember the exact line, about how God was going to look favorably upon them. And then it starts to rain on him. And
Dude,
he just
read,
gives,
you gives read this. We all cliff said that.
Ha ha. He just gives this look up to the heavens that's like, really, right now? When I'm trying to tell this guy that you're going to take care of us, you're going to rain on us.
Didn't they get that from Young Frankenstein? The could be worse, could be raining?
Is that what that's from?
Oh, that's my new number one. Yeah, Sunshine's dumb. Forget it.
Now, Kelly Wan, you've changed Sunshine to The Thing. I'm penciling a new entry in for you.
Yeah.
So that was, by the way, Dingus, I'm with you. When they do the fake CG cold breath, it never works. Whiteout is full of that stuff. And I'm like, oh, that looks terrible. Go back and do it over. It's so hard to do that. I think it looks terrible when people do fake cold breath.
Yeah. It's clear in Henry V that those guys are out there in the cold. And I love how weather, until the Battle of Agincourt, which is where rain should play such a huge part and the water should play such a huge part, and they can't disguise the fact that it's a sunny day that they're shooting it, which, you know, again, is my little education. It's a sunny day and you can't disguise that thing, but that's okay. It's just that weather and mud and water play such a part in how Kenneth Branagh's version of that works out that film just kept coming up for me.
Is mud weather?
Yes, of course. It's a result of weather.
That movie, the core is weather.
Kelly, oh, that's true. The Earth's core stops spinning, and they have to jumpstart it with a nuclear explosion that's planted by a subterranean train made of unobtainium from Avatar. Yeah.
Cameron.
Kelly, what is the 3x3 that we're doing next week? Oh, he's okay.
Get it?
Oh yeah. Nicely done. Oh, now we're gonna have to blank all of this out at the end.
Oh, that'd be such bad news for the listeners. I want to do three stupidest computers now, but since I had one before that, okay, you know how voiceovers always suck and ruin movies, like in Blade Runner and Payback and Spider-Man.
Right, right.
Although I know people who defend the voiceovers of Blade Runner. So maybe that'll be on your list and you'll be.
I'm a Blade Runner voiceover apologist.
Oh, good, good. Okay, well, this is three films with a good voiceover.
I like it. Good. Okay.
Most voiceovers usually are lame.
I like that.
Three that aren't lame.
Okay. Three voiceovers that aren't lame, the end. We'll be back with
that.
Did
I qualify that sufficiently? You guys can
do. You need, it's totally up to you. Otherwise, you know, we might game it and put in space voiceovers.
Well, there's no talking in space because there's no sound. Tell it to George Lucas.
All right, so join us for that 3x3 next week. We will be seeing and discussing Legion, in which I think Paul Bettany is an angel. I hope that's not a spoiler. And we'll also be here with our 3x3 great voiceovers. I am Tom Chick. I am here with Kelly Wand.
Yeah, hi. Sorry.
And Christian
Christian Murawski. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, that's how you say it.
We passed up on the stairs. We spoke of what's and when. Although I wasn't there, he said I was his friend. Which gave us some surprise.
Did I mention I wrote the Jumper video game?